You are listening to Talk Geek TV News number 66, recorded for Wednesday, April the 11th, 2012. You are listening to the Tech Only Hacker Public Radio Edition. To get the full podcast, including political commentary and other controversial topics, please visit www.talkgeektome.us. Here are the vital statistics for this program. Your feedback matters to me. Please send your comments to dg@deepgeek.us. The webpage for this program is at www.talkgeektome.us. You can subscribe to me on Identica as the username DeepGeek, or you could follow me on Twitter. My username there is DGTGTM, as in Deep Geek, Talk Geek to Me. And now the tech roundup. From TorrentFreak.com, by Rick Falkvinge, dated April 4th, 2012, the fight against copyright enforcement and the fight for civil liberties are the same. With the ongoing success of the world's pirate parties, I've seen the copyright industry start to push back, claiming that copyright enforcement can't be tied to civil liberties, that they are two separate issues. That's not a true statement from the copyright industry. The whole point of the fight for net liberties is that the copyright monopoly cannot be enforced without cutting down civil liberties. Here's why. Before the net, if you wanted to send a copy of something that was protected under the copyright monopoly, it was absolutely given that you could do so. You would send that copy in the mail without a single thought or repercussion. You could send copies of drawings. You could send mixtapes of music. You could send copied movies. The reason for this was simple. The right to communicate in private is a fundamental human right, and the copyright monopoly is a commercial distribution monopoly that carries significantly less weight. The problem recently is that civil servants, not politicians, have been tasked with upholding the copyright monopoly. These people are not only unaccountable, but also easily accessible to copyright industry lobbyists, and these civil servants provide background material to the actual decision-making politicians. And if you control the background material, you also control the decision's outcome. Long story short, these civil servants don't care about the cost to society of enforcing the copyright monopoly in a changed communications environment. It's literally not their job. If the issue had been properly politicized, then politicians would be forced to look at more than just the necessary methods for enforcing today's monopoly laws. They would also have to look at the overall cost of society to using those methods, and simply question if those laws are really worth the sacrifices required to uphold them. This is the discussion that needs to happen on the political level, and which the pirate parties are trying to make happen. For when I send a piece of music in an email to somebody, I typically violate the copyright monopoly. When I drop a video clip in a private chat channel, same thing. If I use some other protocol, maybe BitTorrent, same thing. If you are to enforce the copyright monopoly in the connected environment, then you cannot do that without abolishing the right to private communications as a concept, and that's exactly what the copyright industry is trying to do. Let me explain. If there is a list of bit patterns that are illegal to transmit, and such a list could indeed be constructed with today's laws, then the only way to find those bit patterns is to eavesdrop on all the ones and zeros that leave my computer, assemble them by protocol to analyze my communications in the clear, and then sort my transactions into legal and illegal. But you can't do this without breaking and abolishing the postal secret. There is no way to tell one from the other without looking at them in the first place. So, out goes the postal secret, the right to communicate in private. At this point in the discussion, the copyright industry will complain that they only take action for the illegal bit patterns found, and that there is no infraction on the right to legal communications. And in doing so, they put themselves in the exact same spot as the old East German Stasi, which also steamed open all letters sent in the mail, but only took action on those with illegal content, just like the copyright industry describes as their preferred scenario. Stasi, too, sorted legal from illegal, and left the legal alone. With the loss of the right to communicate in private, we also lose several other important rights We lose reporters' right to protect their sources, since such communication happens in the same digitalized private space. We lose a large portion of the ability for attorneys to communicate with their clients. These are considered cornerstones in the construction of checks and balances in the powers of our society, and yet an industry of entertainment middlemen expect to strike them out with a pen in order to uphold a crumbling distribution monopoly? It goes even further. With the loss of private communications, you lose the ability to safely confide in people. The mere suspicion somebody else eavesdropping on your communications will lead you to stay silent. In case the communication would later be used against you, this effect has already been observed on a large scale. Over half of the population are now thinking twice whether to communicate in ways that could later be used against them by a third party, regarding everything from contacting suicide helplines to divorce counseling. So without the ability to confide in people, you even lose your very ability to form an identity. How are you going to come out of the closet, for example, if you can't talk to a trusted friend first? The bottom line is that the fight for basic civil liberties and the fight against the copyright monopoly are one and the same. They are not two identical fights. They are one and the same fight. When our parents sent a letter in the mail, they alone determined whether they wanted to be identified as sender, and nobody had the right to open the letter in transit just to check that the contents were legal. When our parents sent a letter in the mail or placed a phone call, they had an expectation of privacy, considered a fundamental human right. It is entirely reasonable that our children get the same rights, completely, regardless of whether that means that an obsolete distribution industry will go out of business or not. Perhaps the policy of Freenet, the Darknet project, word most clearly how copyright monopoly on today's level simply cannot coexist with freedom of speech. My highlights. Quote, "You cannot guarantee free speech and enforce the copyright monopoly. Therefore, any technology designed to guarantee freedom of speech must also prevent enforcement of copyright monopoly." End quote. From TorrentFreak.com, dated April 4, 2012, by Enigmax. Spanish SOPA, 79 site takedown requests in first month. After being threatened with a place on a United States trade blacklist, the Spanish government passed the so-called SIND law, legislation that allows for the blocking of allegedly infringing sites based on reports from copyright holders. On March the 1st, the SIND law went into effect, and now, a month on, the Spanish Ministry of Culture has revealed that in total almost 300 official complaints have been received. The Copyright Commission has received 213 copyright complaints plus 79 closure requests from rights holders against specific websites accused of online piracy. The Commission will investigate all allegations and has the power to dismiss claims or set the ball rolling for further action, including the removal of links said to infringe on copyright through to the court-ordered closure or ISP blockade of entire websites. Although the process between complaint and site shutdown can in theory be completed in about a month, the Ministry of Culture reports that no punitive action has yet been taken in respect to the 300 complaints. It is not clear how many of the complaints being processed, if any, are the result of a hacktivist sabotage campaign launched on the day the SIND law came into effect. The group Hacktivistas encouraged sites to link to a copyright track from artist Im Navarro, a member of the music rights group SGAE, but also an outspoken critic of the SIND law. Hundreds of websites reportedly linking to Navarro's song without permission, the Navarro subsequently reporting them to the Ministry of Culture. While the initial aim of the campaign was to overload the commission, it was also designed to discover more about the uncertain takedown process. Current thinking suggests that Spanish hosting companies will be asked to shut down non-compliant websites and ISPs will be asked to block those hosted outside Spain. In theory, it's possible to shut down sites within a month, which could mean that the first closures from the first batch reported by the Ministry of Culture will be seen in April. From TechJud.com by Mike Masnick, dated April the 6th, 2012. Mega Upload points out that the feds want to destroy relevant evidence in its case. There are all sorts of problems with the federal government's arguments against Mega Upload. Even if the site and its founders are guilty of breaking the law, it's amazingly troubling to look at the details of how the government has gone about proving this. The most immediate situation, as we've been discussing, involves the handling of the data on Mega Upload servers. Very soon after the raids, the feds told the hosting company that Mega Upload used Carpathia, that it no longer needed the data, and that it could be destroyed. As we pointed out at the time, this made no sense at all. After all, the government is alleging that this content is the center of a criminal conspiracy ring. So why would it want evidence destroyed? Furthermore, it seems likely that there could be plenty of evidence on those servers that support Mega Upload's case. Ah, perhaps that's why the government wants it destroyed. Of course, since then, a bunch of parties, including Mega Upload, EFF, Mega Upload users, and oddly, the MPAA, have gotten involved in trying to preserve the data, while the hosting firm, Carpathia, has asked the court for permission to delete it, get paid for it, or have someone take it off their hands. Mega Upload has specifically offered to pay Carpathia to get the servers, but since the government seized all its assets, it can't do that. Plus, the government has objected to this plan. Furthermore, the MPAA, which still wants the data preserved, has claimed that if the content goes to any third party, it's infringement, and could lead to the revival of Mega Upload. The whole thing is a bit of a mess, and now Mega Upload has pointed out that the government's argument would result in the destruction of key evidence it needs for its case. The filing is very compelling. Quote, "The United States has seized and frozen all of Mega Upload's assets, which, together with those seized from the other defendants, include more than $60 million in cash and well over $100 million all told. In taking this extraordinary step, the government must necessarily be alleging that every dollar of these assets is the proceeds of illegal activity. The basis of this allegation are the government's self-selected copies of a tiny fraction of Carpathia's 1,100-plus servers. Even as to that fraction, the court is asked to assume that every scrap of information on those servers amounts to criminal copyright infringement or perhaps some other illegal activity. If there is logic to the government's actions, there is nothing lawful to be found across Mega Upload's business as reflected on those 1,100-plus servers. Only thus might the government forbid Carpathia from so much as transferring to Mega Upload the Mega servers, housing Mega Upload content. Notably, the government is further forbidding Mega Upload from using any of its assets to pay Carpathia for continued preservation of the Mega servers content, and it has, in the face of Carpathia's earnest submission that it will cease preserving the service absent the requested relief, urged the court to deny such relief because the government has already completed its acquisition of data from Carpathia, service authorized by the warrant. In essence, the government has taken what it wants from the scene of the alleged crime and is content that the remaining evidence, even if it is exculpatory or otherwise relevant to the defense, be destroyed. And by refusing to permit Mega Upload to use its assets to mount a defense, the government is effectively making sure that Mega Upload has no practical way to preserve the evidence itself. Such a course proceeding by the government would be troubling in any circumstance, but this is, of course, a criminal case. It is, in fact, what the government has called the largest such case it has ever brought in the history of alleged copyright infringement. If the government's position now wins the day, the integrity of what ensues will be lost. The Mega servers will have been wiped, and potentially exculpatory or relevant evidence will have been spoliated in mass before being properly surveyed by the parties, not to mention the court. The government's case may be advantaged by this course of action, but much else will suffer, and due process will not permit it." End quote. The filing also rips to shreds the Justice Department's claim that the content should be destroyed because some of it may contain child pornography, noting that it appears the U.S. government is advocating the destruction of evidence of child porn rather than using it to capture those responsible. Quote, its reasoning then becomes altogether mystifying when it asserts without any substantiation, quote, that Carpathia servers may contain child pornography, rendering the Carpathia servers contraband, unquote. To take the government at its word, therefore, it at best is greeting with equanimity, and at worst is advocating the imminent destruction of evidence of child pornography. It is passing strange for the government to express preference for the destruction of evidence of criminal misconduct over the preservation of it for criminal investigation, end of quote. The filing is worth reading, as it goes on in great detail about the ridiculousness of the government's position and how it is clearly destroying important evidence in this case, hoping to set it up so that Mega Upload can only use the sliver of evidence that the government chooses to make available to it. And it's doing this before the actual case begins, where Mega Upload doesn't even know the full details about what evidence is being presented and how it can defend itself. Without that, it's highly questionable and almost certainly a violation of due process to support the destruction of evidence when Mega Upload doesn't even know what evidence it needs to defend itself. As Tim Lee writes at the link above about this filing, this whole situation looks really bad for the government and seems completely contrary to our basic concepts of due process and innocent until proven guilty. Quote, the government's intransigence on the preservation of evidence is the latest example of the government's scorched earth approach to the Mega Upload prosecution. Theoretically, criminal defendants are innocent until proven guilty. Yet the seizure of Mega Upload servers, freezing of its assets, and arrest of its top executives did immense damage to the company long before they had a chance to tell their side of the story to the jury. Now, the government seems to be trying to deny Mega Upload the opportunity to fully defend itself in court. Mega Upload may be found guilty, but like everyone else, it has the right to a fair trial. Indeed, Mega Upload may not be a sympathetic defendant at all, and may very well have violated the law, but if the government truly believes it has a strong case, why is it trying so hard to destroy so much evidence? If the case is as strong as the Justice Department makes it out to be, then surely it can withstand Mega Upload and have access to all the evidence. That the Justice Department is fighting so hard to destroy evidence in the case seems like a clear admission that it knows its case is incredibly weak. From EFF.org, dated April 5, 2012, by Corinne McSherry, Viacom vs. Google, a decision at last. And it's mostly good for the internet and innovation. The internet can breathe a sigh of relief today. In the latest twist in the long-running Viacom vs. YouTube litigation, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals revived the entertainment giant's suit against Google, but simultaneously eviscerated most of the legal theories on which the lawsuit was based. Here's the quick and dirty. Back in 2010, a district court threw out Viacom's suit against YouTube, finding that the safe harbors outlined in the DMCA protected YouTube from all copyright liability. Viacom appealed based on unprecedented legal theories that, if adopted, would have rendered the DMCA safe harbors a dead letter. Today's decision largely affirms that earlier ruling finding that YouTube is protected from liability, except where the company actually knew of, or was willfully blind to, specific instances of infringement of material at issue in the case, or facts of circumstances indicating such specific infringement. The appellate court also held that YouTube could be on the hook if it was willfully blind to specific infringement, but stressed that YouTube did not have a duty to monitor user activities. In other words, the company can't have made a deliberate effort to avoid guilty knowledge, but that doesn't mean it had an affirmative duty to seek out infringing activity. And in a bit of technical point, the court said it was unclear whether syndicating clips might be the kind of activity contemplated by the safe harbors, but that it needed more facts as to whether any of the clips at issue were actually syndicated. Finally, The court also suggests that YouTube might be liable if it had exerted substantial influence on the infringing activities of users. The court sent the case back to district court for more fact-finding on the unresolved issues, which means the case will linger on. For now, this leaves a few questions that the district court will have to address unless the case finally settles. What's that all add up to? A loss for YouTube, probably a small one. It is likely that only a small subset of clips remain in play, and YouTube's current practices are not at issue. But, on balance, a win for internet users and innovation. Indeed, while some have declared it a Viacom victory, it has to be a Pyrrhic one at best, given the decision firmly and correctly rejected most of Viacom's litigation agenda, an agenda that would have upended the DMCA safe harbors on which so much internet expression relies. To read the rest of this story, including the details of the point of the litigation, follow links in the show notes. From EFF.org, dated April 5, 2012, by Rainey Reitman. April 2012, the state of Do Not Track, lead up to tracking, protecting working group negotiations in Washington, D.C. Things are heating up in the Do Not Track campaign. Next week, EFF Technology Projects Director Peter Eckersley will be joining internet engineers, privacy advocates, and industry groups in Washington, D.C. for the intense negotiations around the future of online tracking. Here's our overview of the latest developments likely to influence the Do Not Track campaign during the crucial upcoming weeks. W3C Tracking Protection Working Group convenes in D.C. On April the 10th, the World Wide Web Consortium, the W3C, Tracking Protection Working Group, will be convening in Washington, D.C. The W3C is an international community that develops protocols and guidelines that ensure the long-term growth of the web. Among other things, the Tracking Protection Working Group is charged with defining internet standards for the Do Not Track flag, thereby a user concerned with protecting personal privacy can use a one-click setting in her browser to set up an HTTP header that will tell websites she does not want to be tracked. The W3C group is engaged in an intricate series of negotiations to achieve consensus around how websites should respond when they receive the Do Not Track header. The April meeting may see some of the most difficult decisions. According to the public schedule, the group will be tackling issues such as the definitional distinction between first and third-party websites, the types of tracking exemptions necessary for fraud detection and defense, and data usage by first-party websites. Consumer advocates will be pushing to get meaningful standards in place so that individuals can maintain their privacy when they use the web, while some industry participants will likely attempt to include exceptions and loopholes that allow retention and use of large amounts of linkable data from opted-out users. The W3C process is a multi-stakeholder forum bringing in industry figures and advocacy groups, and the details of meetings and draft documents are posted online for public discussion. This stands in sharp contrast to the decision-making process of groups like the Digital Advertising Alliance, which is also concocting standards around the Do Not Track flag. The DAA is an industry-only coalition of the biggest internet advertisers and is not engaging users, internet engineers, or advocacy organizations. Similarly, the DAA does not post its draft documents, meetings, notes, and other discussion points on the internet for transparency and discussion. EFF strongly believes that discussions around the Do Not Track flag need to be kept in the open format of the W3C working group. Yahoo's Do Not Track leaves much to be desired. Last week, Yahoo committed to supporting the Do Not Track on its sites by early summer, but unfortunately, Yahoo's conception of Do Not Track is pretty weak when it comes to respecting user privacy. While we appreciate Yahoo's announcement as a step in the right direction, the commitment, similar to the vague statement put forth by the industry group DAA, did not promise to actually reduce the tracking of individuals. Yahoo merely promised a Do Not Target, not a Do Not Track. According to the press release, Yahoo promised to provide a simple step for consumers to express their ad targeting preferences to Yahoo. But Do Not Track isn't about expressing a preference about viewing targeted advertisements. It's designed to combat the issue of rampant data collection. As we've noted before, online tracking companies are embedding pieces of tracking code on websites around the web and using increasingly sophisticated mechanisms for tracking our online reading habits. Even sophisticated users may find it difficult or impossible to fend off these online trackers, and the industry has thus far failed to provide a tenable solution for dealing with this problem. That's why Do Not Track was invented, to give users a meaningful choice when it comes to fending off online tracking. It's not merely a mechanism of adjusting the types of ads that are displayed when a user loads a web page. IAB president lashes out at Do Not Track. At the Interactive Advertising Bureau's, the IAB, annual leadership meeting, President and CEO Randall Rothenberg lashed out against the work of internet engineers and privacy advocates who are working to support Do Not Track. The Interactive Advertising Bureau is a consortium of media and technology companies that, according to their website, are responsible for selling 86% of online advertising in the United States. Dismissing the concerns of advocates and civil libertarians, Rothenberg attacked the W3C process and the Do Not Track flag, warning member companies it could kill their business. Rothenberg opened up the conference with a speech encouraging members to educate themselves in the multi-stakeholder process because political activists have infiltrated internet standards bodies like the World Wide Web Consortium, the W3C, and the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, the ICANN. By political activists, Rothenberg is likely referring to nonprofits working for a free, privacy-protective internet, like EFF, Center for Digital Democracy, and Mozilla. Rothenberg described this infiltration as a disastrous occurrence. For those that do not educate themselves about the meetings, Rothenberg warned, "What you don't know can hurt you and kill your company." Rothenberg also said that Do Not Track will, quote, "create the potential for the global blacklisting of legitimate news," end of quote. He went on to compare efforts to create strong privacy protections for individual users as, quote, "even more threatening to interactive media and commerce than SOPA and PIPA," end of quote. Let's get real. Heavy-handed copyright enforcement regimes supported by the MPAA and RIAA are bad for internet users. Similarly, ubiquitous, uncontrollable data collection programs by online tracking companies are bad for internet users. Whether EFS is championing meaningful privacy protections or combating lopsided anti-piracy bills, we're working to create an internet for the future generations that upholds values of free expression, individual privacy, and innovation. And as longtime internet champion Professor Lawrence Lessig articulates quite well, while there are a plethora of laws and technological protections that enforce copyright to the detriment of user experience, there are scant protections for individuals trying to protect their privacy on the internet. That's why negotiations around Do Not Track are so vital. Users are ready for real solution when it comes to online tracking. A 2012 telephone poll by Pew Research found that 68% of respondents are not okay with behavioral advertising, as EFF joins advocates, internet engineers, and industry groups in discussions next week. We'll be looking to move the ball forward on meaningful privacy protection so that future generations of internet users will have the choice to browse the internet free from electronic trackers. News from TechDirt.com, audio of Moment of Clarity number 129, MaggieMcNeil.wordpress.com, InTheseTimes.com, and AllGov.com, used under arranged permissions. News from EFF.org and TorrentFreak.com, used under permission of the Creative Commons by Attribution License. News from WisconsinGreenParty.org is a press release. News sources retain their respective copyrights. Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Geek to Me. Here are the vital statistics for this program. Your feedback matters to me. Please send your comments to dg@deepgeek.us. The webpage for this program is at www.talkgeektome.us. You can subscribe to me on Identica as the username DeepGeek, or you could follow me on Twitter. My username there is DGTGTM, as in Deep Geek, Talk Geek to Me.
This episode of Talk Geek to Me is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 Unported license. This license allows commercial reuse of the work, as well as allowing you to modify the work, so long as you share alike the same rights you have received under this license.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Geek to Me.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.